very much. I'd like to introduce our next speaker from the USGS, Mike Dettinger.
Brian, we'll start. I'll just press stop. Okay. Okie doke. As you can see, this is actually going to be kind of a from the title you can tell it's going to be a bit of a sprawl across several aspects of atmospheric rivers. Very stuff of life there in the Southwest, I'll spoil it for you all. It's kind of water, and if I'm really pushed, my examples of the very stuff of life, in this case, I think two or three out of four, but anyway, all but one of them is the real stuff of life in the Southwest, which is floods. And that's supposed to ingratiate me with the FMA. But, you'll see that basically in many settings in the West, it really does come down to all about the floods. So we've already heard a lot about atmospheric rivers. Everyone has heard a lot about atmospheric rivers. These are some headlines from this past winter, and they reflect mostly the panic that happens when people hear the word atmospheric river coming their way. Down in the corner there is the truth of it. They're a blessing and a curse. But we're kind of, Marty and I and the whole center are working at trying to get to a place where we communicate better about the full range of impacts of atmospheric rivers. But we've heard several times how much precipitation these can bring. And just show you this slide, which is the shows the numbers of occasions in that 59-year period there when more than 16 inches of precipitation was recorded at a co-op weather station in 3 days. And this is all of them. Okay, there are 6,000 or 8,000 co-op stations around the country, the CONUS, but this is all of them. You see sort of 16 inches is put in perspective by the Harvey, little inset about Harvey down there. But this is a lot of water in 3 days. And you can see two clusters here where these have happened historically. It's in the Southeast where you get the landfalling hurricanes and tropical storms and that sort of thing. And out here, really mostly in California, in the coastal ranges and the Sierra Nevada. And as it says there, some 92% of these occasions when you got more than 16 inches in 3 days have occurred during atmospheric rivers. I'll just say that 16 inches sounds pretty random, but in metric, it's all very smooth and nice. Our biggest storms here in the West are associated 92% of the time by this particular metric with atmospheric rivers. And our biggest storms out here in the West are really quite comparable to, or greater than those in most of the country. With the exception down in the hurricane belt. But even there, the numbers until we got to about Harvey, the numbers are pretty comparable. The biggest storms on this three-day basis are quite comparable in our mountains and in the hurricane belt. So they're a big deal. Big deal. Because of that, they're a big deal in terms of floods. This is some work that we published.
Could you say a few words about the underlying physics of an atmospheric river?
No. No. I only got 20 minutes, so no. I'm sorry, that's a different talk. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that.
I'll do that.
Okay, yeah. This shows the fraction of annual peak stream flows, it's sort of the annual floods historically that occurred during atmospheric rivers. And the blue colors here are over 80 to 90% of all the annual peak flows have been associated with atmospheric rivers. and it grades on down along the west coast to greens there, which are in the vicinity of half of the annual peak flows for atmospheric rivers. As you move inland into the southwest, we go into the reds, which is where historically not a large fraction, eventually in some of these areas, a negligible fraction of the annual peak flows have been atmospheric rivers. That's not to say that atmospheric rivers don't get in there and make floods once in a while. They're just not the dominant source of floods. To give you a sense of that, here is, I've just laid over it, a flood frequency, a simple-minded flood frequency analysis for the Truckee River at Reno. And so the dots there are lining up the annual peak flows over whatever, that's a 55-year record or whatever that is up there, 65, I guess. And the color of the dot is associated with the kind of storm or condition that was associated with that peak flow. The blues over there at the high end of the flows over on the right there are all atmospheric rivers. By the time you get to less large storms, if you will, less large floods down here, we have a mix where you start to see an awful lot of reds. Those are spring snowmelt peaks. And some other storms as green are showing up here and there all over the place. Look at the pie chart there above the dashed line, above 5,000 CFS. And, some 75% of all of those peak floods that have been more than 5,000 CFS have been atmospheric rivers. And I was glad that I have this in here because this goes to Janine's question about Benson's stuff. This is really the headwaters for the Pyramid Lake, which is one of the important lakes that Benson was looking at. And at least historically, those big floods, any big floods or frankly big inputs of water into the lake, any steps in the lake levels upward, you know, 3/4 of them are likely to be atmospheric rivers. But as Matthew said, you're not going to, we don't have a way of tagging them yet to be sure that that continues into the past, et cetera. But anyway, so this is pushing past the Sierra Nevada and getting, you know, this is the rain shadowed side of the Sierra Nevada here. We have a setting here where the big floods are almost universally atmospheric rivers. I'm trying to push into the southwest beyond California as much as possible in this talk. This is a difficult figure, but it's from that same paper that had the one with 6,000 flood dots on it a moment ago. And So these are 2-degree boxes here across the west. And the upper number, where there's color in an upper number, is how often you get an AR into the area with a daily integrated vapor transport, integrated vapor transport greater than 500 kgm per second. That's a pretty arbitrary break point, but it's getting into a large atmospheric river range. And if you look at these, the numbers per year, so the top number in each of these boxes on the west coast here is how many of these per year. And you see that you know, along the west coast, it's one or two of them you see per year for the most part. By the time we get to that upper dashed circle there, that's pretty much Truckee at the Reno area. It's roughly 1 year in five they get in that far, one as big as that. The lower number is when those bigger ones arrive, what percentage of the time do you get a flood as measured by a greater than 50 millimeters per second runoff generation is a metric that we used for declaring a flood. And so you see up there in the upper circle there that number is about 60% of the time. When you get a big one into that area, you get a flood, okay? I put this up here as much as anything because to give you a sense that actually the really big ARs don't get in very often historically, and down here in the extreme southwest, down here in the yellow area, we're just simply not generating floods this way, okay? So, you know, there isn't a single answer in the southwest as to the importance of atmospheric rivers for floods. Switching over a little bit to this, I don't think we've seen this figure, but we've heard sort of remarks about it or things like this, which is the percentage of the overall precipitation that comes from atmospheric rivers, okay? And this is work that John Rutz did with Marty and others. And basically, the map there, the oranges into yellows are where you get from 35 to greater than 55% of the, in this case, winter precipitation coming from atmospheric rivers. You can see it falls off pretty quickly as you go inland. And then the next tier, as it says here, the next tier of states inland, sort of parts of Nevada, Idaho, Arizona, and the like, we're seeing numbers that are closer to 25% of the precipitation is still coming from atmospheric rivers on average. And then eventually, they're just not penetrating there often enough to give you much precipitation, and there are other competing storm mechanisms, precipitation mechanisms. I'll just point out the most obvious thing on this thing is that finger that comes out of Utah and points right at Bishop or something like that. That's the rain shadow of four atmospheric rivers of the highest part of the Sierra Nevada. But I'm not sure if we can do this. Well, but that egg-shaped thing up there, a little bit inland, is the Truckee story that I was telling you. There's a place where the conditions of lots of atmospheric rivers hitting sort of the northern Sierra Nevada and the ridge lines being low enough that you get enough over there that you start to see them being a big contributor in northwesternmost Nevada. I'm actually going to buy myself some time and just say, you know, in parts of the desert southwest, here's on the Mojave River aquifer system, these things are really important for just getting water into the aquifers. I was going to skip this one, but you know, most of the time the river is dry. That isn't muddy water, that's sand there. But when it flows, and it also recharges, as you might imagine. You put a bunch of water on, 4 feet of water on top of a sandbox, you're going to get some water into the ground. And down here, you can see that most of the times when we get enough flow there to actually make some serious recharge, they're atmospheric rivers. I will say in this setting, when a flow comes through like this one actually illustrated down here in bottom left, in this case, there were wells about 10 miles away from the river, uphill from the river, that rose by 80 feet in 2 days. The water levels rose by 80 feet in 2 days during that event. So a lot of water goes into this aquifer that way. But I mentioned drought busters. This is a complicated slide. I mostly showed it over there on the right is the usual story as I tell it, which is the West Coast story. As you come down the West Coast, when you start up in Washington State, something over 70% of the historical droughts have ended with one or two atmospheric rivers arriving in a month. And then it kind of grades off as we head south until by the time we get to Southern California, it's more like 30% of the historical droughts have been broken by atmospheric rivers. So they're a big player on the West Coast. All this stuff over here on the other side is a very related story, but basically what this is saying is that this is looking at all these dots, which are climate divisions around the U.S., and asking the question, how do droughts end Do we come out of droughts kind of gradually? Or do we come out of droughts suddenly and in a big way? The couple of graphs up at the top, the one on the top there is how we come out of droughts, and that's PDSI, Palmer Drought Severity Index, on the y-axis, and basically what that's showing, and I don't have time to take you through it, but what that's showing is that on average over some 25 droughts historically that we looked at there, this in the month when you go from drought status to not drought status, the PDSI shifts by almost 3 PDSI units, which is a huge, the whole PDSI range is from about -5 to +3 or +4 or +5. So that's a big chunk of change. The next figure down there is how you go into drought, and it's much more gradual. There's no big step, generally speaking. You just kind of slide into drought. What this map is showing, and I put it up there mostly because it gives you a sense of what's happening in the Southwest, is all the yellows and oranges are places where you get a step that's, you know, like instead of a fraction of a PDSI unit is how things change as you go into drought. Fraction, you slide into drought. That two, the twos there are like the upper thing there. That's how you get out of a drought. So frankly, all across the US you see that we go into droughts gradually, and we come out of droughts, frankly, with a flood in many, many, many cases, but rapidly and with great drama, we come out of droughts. And the Southwest is right there, you know, as part of that. But, okay, so a question came up earlier about the role of ARs in terms of whether we're in drought or not. And this is always, well, this is my kind of prototypical picture of how that works for us, in this case in Central California. The black curve there are the water year precipitation totals over a large part of Central California, with a five-year moving average run over them just to make it easier to see what's going on when I have three different curves up there. The red and green are the contributions from the top 5% of all storms historically, all wet days historically, let me be a little bit more specific there, is red, and green is from everything else, the other 95% of wet days historically. And again, five-year moving average, just because if I had histograms of all of them, your heads would explode. But basically what you can see there is that most, you know, two-thirds of the water, oh, I should say red and green adds up to black. It's just, yeah, this is true. Exactly, I should say, I suppose. So green is up there. Two-thirds of the water on average comes from the 95% of storms ranging from minimal to moderate to big even, but not quite top five percentile. The red is the other third. A third is coming from 5% of the wet days. But if you look at the variability, how the range from year to year, you know, all that variability in the upper black curve is coming from the red one. So year-to-year variations in total precipitation are all about the largest storms. They're all about the largest storms. And if you don't like wiggle matching, here I've plotted the total precipitation on the x-axis and the contributions from the red and green curves on the y-axis. And you can see the R-squareds there for unfiltered stuff. Take away that five-year moving average. That's the lighter colored dots, I should say, are the unfiltered years. And, you know, 85% of the year-to-year variation can be explained by just knowing what's going on with the top 5% of all wet days historically, not the top five in a given year, but the top five of all days historically. So these big storms dictate when we're going in and out of droughts and pluvials, to use Matt's expression, there. And if you look at one class of ARs, the Pineapple Expresses, making landfall in Northern and Central California each year, the numbers of them, that's this bottom curve. And when I run the little five-year moving average thing through it, that's the orange curve. And the R-squared between that curve and either the red curve or the black curve up above, the R-squared is like 70%, okay? I'm rounding, obviously. So, you know, ARs, the number of ARs we get coming in this case, number of Pineapple Expresses coming in each year, end up dictating 70% of whether we're in a drought or a pluvial period. This is Central California. Here's doing the same thing over there in Northwest Nevada with the Northwest Nevada Climate Division, which is kind of the northwest quarter of the state of Nevada, kind of averaged together. And same story, actually. The R-squared is virtually the same, okay? So it's getting past this year enough to be the big kahuna in terms of pluvial or drought. It's the number of atmospheric rivers coming in. Pushing back to this drought-busting thing, here are the counts for the Northwest Nevada area of how many of the historical droughts have been busted by atmospheric rivers coming in a given month and just changing the whole situation. For all drought breaks over that 60-ish year period there, it's 57% of them have been atmospheric rivers. At the same latitude over on the other side in California, it's 40%. So as a matter of fact, in terms of breaking droughts, atmospheric rivers are more important in Northwest Nevada on the far side of the Sierra than they are in the Central Valley, for instance. And then if we narrow into just cool season drought breaks, or really wet season drought breaks, whatever, it's almost 90% of them in Northwest Nevada are associated with atmospheric rivers. So atmospheric rivers break our droughts. They give us pluvial versus drought. They're very basic to how our system works. Here's pushing all the way over to the Utah border, Northeast Nevada, and similar story going on with everything, except for basically that R squared down here in the lower left shows that now we've gone from 69% there to about 26%. So fewer are getting that far. They're still playing a substantial role, but it's not this, you know, if I know the atmospheric river contribution in Truckee or in the Central Valley, I'm sorry, I can more or less stop there. I've got 90% of the story in hand. You know, I've got 70% of the story in hand. Well, it's not quite that way by the time we get pushed that far. Here's actually down by Vegas, in the southernmost Nevada. And here the story breaks down a lot. And so actually the business of big storms still being the dominant force is actually even larger here. The variance you can see is even more so coming from the red curve rather than the green curve. And the other thing I'm showing here, I put in just this coloring filling on the green curve, which remember is small to big, but not the biggest storms. And it's sort of to lead your eye to compare it to the PDO there. So in southernmost Nevada, the situation appears to be the atmospheric rivers don't play a big role. I should say the R-squared between that the Pineapple Express arrivals that would be pointed at Vegas and the black or red curves up above, in this case is like 6% or something. It's not statistically significant. So that's not a big player. But there what we find is that, you know, they're driving the things like the PDO in this case don't pretty much drive the red curve here, the biggest storm contributions. They drive the everything else. But that's an interesting break that we see there. And I can tell you, we don't see that in Central California nor in Northwest Nevada. So now we're seeing a different forcing. It's not giving us those big sweeping pluvial drought swings, but it is telling, you know, that's where Pacific climate shows up in this whole scheme of things for Las Vegas. Okay, so now I just want to kind of bring this home in terms of you know, life bringers sort of thing, and just a couple examples here. This one is from the from San Francisco Bay and Delta system up in Central California, and the time series up at the top is something called X2, which is basically a measure of how far, how to say it for this audience, you know, how far the fresh water has pushed the salt water back in the Delta and Bay out towards the ocean. You can turn it around and say how far the salt water has come in. The larger the number here, the latter is probably a better way to say it, because the larger the number here, the further in the salt water, salinity and the like, seawater essentially has come in. And you can see these big sweeps. And down here, what that map is just showing is sort of what a 40, where the salt water ends with a 40 versus where it ends with a 90 or so there. You know, it's kind of the swinging in and out. If I look at that for the largest swings of this salinity, in particular the largest freshenings of the estuary historically, 83% of those, of the, you know, the largest, I picked a number there of 0.85 kilometers in a single day that the freshening has pushed the salt out, have been due to atmospheric rivers. That 80% number is going to always shows up because it's how often we see these things making floods. Another aspect of that is how often you get inundations of some of our floodplains in the Central Valley. This is the Yolo Bypass, and basically this what's being measured here is how long this part of the floodplain is inundated historically, and then for each of the cases where it's been inundated for various lengths of time, the red part of the bar is how, you know, the ones that began, those inundations were started by arrival of an atmospheric river, and to make it, well, percentages of inundations, so it's not absolute numbers, it's the blue curve. And you can see that it starts for the shortest inundation, or for all of them, it's about 55% of all the inundations of the Yolo Bypass have been due to atmospheric rivers, or at least initiated by atmospheric rivers. By the time I get out to a month or more, it's long since leveled off to about 80% of those. Again, 80%, that's floods basically we're talking about there. The only reason why I mention this, and I'm almost done, so I'm going to take that excursion. Up in the upper right there are two sets of salmon, baby salmon, or children salmon. The ones on the left there, the little dinky ones, have been, were basically, that's what they grow to in the river channels themselves. On the right there, that's what they grow to in the same amount of time on the floodplains when they're inundated. So, you know, the success of our salmon fisheries, the success of our fisheries in many cases, you know, we need those floodplains to be inundated. Floods are not always a bad thing. So, I think one more slide. And that is, oh boy, that turned out really fuzzy. I'm not sure what happened there. So this is just taking it to the whole Southwest. And this is some analysis I did with Christine Albano in the past year and a half or so, where we looked at, you know, we counted how many times or how much precipitation came out of atmospheric rivers making landfall at various places on the West Coast. I'm showing 35, it's covered up there, 32.5 and then 25 north. That's way down in Baja. But correlated that amount of precipitation each year to how green from satellite data the landscape was in the following summer. Okay, so this is about the greenness in the Southwest, across the Southwest. And we get this, you know, up where we've mostly focused on atmospheric rivers up in Northern California, we get, as far as the interior Southwest, we get some stuff, you know, up there in Northwestern Nevada. As we push down, actually I should be doing this. So bang, it gets in there. Ta-da. Animation time. The ones coming in out of Southern California, we're seeing this sort of pattern. And what's happening here is that, you know, we're getting actually water is making it all the way up to the northernmost Nevada, all the way up to the northern end of the Great Basin, and you know, benefiting the vegetation and the like that far north. And actually, if you look at that last arrow there, it has to do with, that's the direction that the basins and ranges are aligned to. So these things get into the Great Basin, get into the basin and range, and they're just, the atmospheric rivers, moisture is just sort of channeled up northward, up through the Great Basin, and ultimately crashes into mountains at the far north end of the basin. And then down there in the south, you know, the ones coming in from Baja, it's clipped off there a bit, obviously, but basically this is the sort of thing that Marty was talking about.
I apologize. I
know, that's my last slide, so we can stop there.